The Wall Street Journal called it the self-checkout that even haters will love. Uniqlo's self-checkout technology works like magic. Just throw your stuff into the bin and that's it. What's behind that? Cameras and nifty transformer-based AI object recognition running on 25,000 NVIDIA H100s? Turns out it's something you might have heard before. Radio Frequency Identification Tags, or RFID. RFID is everywhere in everyday life. Tags in supply chain management, tags in your passport, toll collection tags, and now self-checkout tags. Funny thing is, for something so ubiquitous, it's not exactly clear where this technology actually comes from. So in this video, we explore the murky origins of RFID. But before we begin, let's talk about Venus. One of my top 5 videos of all time covers the Soviet Venera program, the 16-plus missions the Soviets sent to Venus. I consume virtually everything I can find about Venus, which is why I'm excited to tell you about Magellan TV. It is full of the type of documentaries I watched when I was a kid. Check out the documentary Venus, Death of a Planet to learn the insane conditions that turned Venus into what it is today. Click on the link in the description below and start watching Venus, Death of a Planet ad-free. If you enjoy the channel, I know you'll love what you can find on Magellan TV. And I got another rec coming up later, stay tuned for that. So how does RFID as we know it today work? The system has two visible components, a reader and a tag, plus an invisible one, a database. The tag can either be passively or actively powered. An active tag is attached to a power source, like your fast-track RFID thingy, official term, which you put on your dashboard. These offer more range. And then there are passive tags. These have shorter ranges but don't need an attached power source like a battery. These passive tags are made up of a chip and antenna wrapped up in some protective packaging. During operations, the reader emits a small electromagnetic pulse. The tag receives the pulse, and from this pulse, the tag's chip gets just enough power from the reader to wake up and transmit a response. That response might contain ID information, but can be more than just that, depending on the chip's memory storage. The tag's antenna will do this signaling via backscattering, meaning that they will reflect a radio signal from the reader in such a way that it contains the necessary info, like an echo, but with a twist. The upside of RFID is that, unlike barcodes, they do not require visual line of sight. RFID tags can also carry far more information than just a barcode, and several can be read simultaneously. The downside is that they cost more than barcode stickers, like 5 to 25 cents depending on the spec. I'm not sure what node makes these chips, but I've seen mentions of 180 nanometers. There are a plethora of variations in the sprawling RFID shared universe, but that is the core concept. Now, where does it come from? It is World War II, and the Allies have a powerful new tool, radar. Radar worked by projecting radio waves from a transmitter and then reading the waves reflecting back from an object up ahead. A major issue with this radar, however, was that it could not tell whether an object was a friend or foe. In response, Germany's bombers began tailgating returning RAF planes, bypassing British defensive radars. In response to this spectacular failure, the British rigged up a variety of quote, identification friend or foe, end quote, devices, affectionately nicknamed Reply or Die. One of these IFF systems used an interrogator responser setup. An interrogator sends out a short pulse of radio waves that the responser picks up and responds with a ping of its own. These devices have been cited as one of the precursors of RFID. The ideas are indeed similar, but RFID technology as we know it today does not directly descend from it. In 1948, a radio student in America named Harry Stockman published a landmark paper titled Communication by Means of Reflected Power. Stockman was born in Sweden and traveled to the United States to study radio engineering. I dug up a 1940 article mentioning him being unable to return to Sweden thanks to the war, but was not able to find much more after that. In this 1948 paper, Stockman proposed using reflected radio, light, or sound waves as a means of communicating information. He pointed out that radars basically use the same principle, conveying a simple yes-no idea. His proposal was that you have a radiation source at point A, sending radiation at a special reflector at point B. The reflector reflects back the radiation, but in such a way to encode information to be picked up by a receiver at point A. We often point to this paper as the technical foundation of RFID, and it is indeed the first explicit underlining of the concept in the literature. But there were major technical challenges, for instance, the difficulties in separating signal from noise or properly modulating the response signal. In his conclusion, Stockman wrote, "Evidently, considerable research and development work has to be done before the remaining basic problems in reflected power communication are solved, and before the field of useful applications is explored." Unbeknownst to Stockman and most others, there was an example of his proposal already out there in the wild. It comes out of the Soviet Union, created by the genius Russian inventor Leon Theremin. Most well known for his musical instruments, Theremin had settled in the United States before returning to the Soviet Union in 1938 for unclear reasons. Tax difficulties, worries of war, or kidnapping, who knows. Anyway, back in the Soviet Union, he worked on a number of secret projects for the NKVD, perhaps the most famous of which is the Great Seal Bug. It has two components, a resonant cavity and an antenna. So when people talked in the room, the sound waves caused a membrane inside the cavity to change. These changes in turn affected the radio antenna. If you direct a high-frequency radio beam at the antenna, like from a van parked across the street, then that antenna will reflect back a modulated beam that lets us decode the sounds inside the room. Wicked smart. One such device was concealed inside a plaque of the Great Seal of the United States and presented to the U.S. by some Soviet schoolchildren in 1945. The thing, as it was called, sat for several years inside the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, listening in on conversations until the British accidentally exposed it in 1952. Before we move on, I got a Magellan TV documentary recommendation that is classic agentometry. I really should have done something like this for the channel, but now I don't have to. The Saturn V remains the only rocket to have carried humans beyond low Earth orbit. It is one of the most impressive machines ever built, and it is full of semiconductors. I loved this documentary, the Saturn V story, and I think you'll love it too. The link is in the description below. You can support the channel and watch great videos like this. Thanks. The first real use case of modernish RFID technology was in security, electronic article surveillance, or EAS. As shoplifting became a more serious problem for U.S. retailers, a wave of new radio tag systems were introduced to combat it. You're probably familiar with these plastic tags. They were first invented by a guy from Queens named Arthur Minassi. An engineer by training and a shoplifter himself back in his youth, Arthur invented what he called the no-go. No-go, get it? In 1962, in his garage, Arthur put down $100,000 of his own money to refine the device, and it entered the market in 1966. A little plastic disc, it sold for about 25 cents to a dollar. The No-Go Corporation became one of the leaders in EAS systems, but there were others too. No-Go's biggest competitor was Sensormatic Electronics, founded in 1968, which came to dominate the market. Another big one was Checkpoint. These devices were very simple. A No-Go wafer had a metal coil inside it that reacted to electromagnetic waves, radio or microwave, generated by a checkpoint. These early EAS tag wafers contained a single bit, 1 or 0, signaling whether the tag was active or not. Cost and complexity prevented us from having these tags contain any more information. Early EAS devices were hidden inside the item, which made them too effective. Memorably, at a military exchange store, the commanding officer's wife got caught by a Sensormatic tag, which got the company thrown out. It was quickly learned that it was better to deter thieves rather than directly confronting them. They then developed the more prominent tags you see today. Still gives me anxiety, though, when I walk through the gates. In 1991, Minassi's no-go wafers were accepted into the Smithsonian Institution. He passed away in 1994 from pneumonia, a very rich man. Two major patents, filed and granted in the early 1970s, are often pointed to as RFID's origin. First, we have Charles Walton, a former IBM researcher born in England. He founded a company called Proximity Devices, offering a radio-operated door lock system. In this system, there's a small electrical current sent from a radio transceiver inside the lock. A current wakes up a passive card, which responds to open the lock. Walton tried to get General Motors to adopt it, but they thought it was too Buck Rogers, meaning crazy futuristic. But the lock-making company Schlage liked it enough to license it. And thus we get those key cards that we wave around to get into our hotel rooms. Walton's patents are responsible for two of the four most widely used systems. He is also widely credited with giving RFID its name. It first appears in a later 1983 patent of his. Walton's patents are now expired, but over their 17-year life, they earned him $3 million, enough for a nice 2-acre house in Los Gatos, where Netflix is now headquartered. He continued inventing for the rest of his life. The second significant patent is from Dr. Mario Cardullo. Cardullo was trained as an aeronautics and mechanical engineer and had worked on the Apollo program. After that, he joined a company called Communications Satellite Corporation. Famously, the idea for Cardullo's patent first came to him in 1969 while on a flight from Washington to St. Paul to see the Archbishop there. He sat next to an IBM engineer who was struggling with a project called CarTrack. CarTrack was an optical barcode system for railroad cars, but the IBM engineer was having trouble with reading the barcodes on the car's sides. Mud, dirt, and vandalism obscured the reflected surfaces, making them hard to read. Inspired by British IFF systems that he heard about as a kid, as well as the popular EAS systems of the day, Cardullo sketched into his notebook a possible solution. His tag sketch had several components befitting that of modern RFID systems: a transmitter, a receiver, internal memory, and a power source. After finishing, he signed and dated the sketch and moved on with his life. Cardullo later left ComSat to start his own company. He and his team drafted up a few product ideas, the second of which was the RFID tag Cardullo sketched out in 1969. In January 1971, they demonstrated the item, named the Encoder, to the Port Authority in New York as an automatic toll-collecting solution. The Port Authority turned them down. Their reasoning was that if someone did not have the tag and went through the transceivers, then you would have to take a photo of their license plate. The Port Authority claimed that would be a violation of privacy laws. Cardullo later left his company due to disputes with the investors, and it collapsed. Meanwhile, the Port Authority goes to GE, Philips, and other companies to commission the same product. This essentially violated Cardullo's 1973 patent, but unfortunately Cardullo could not afford to sue for infringement. The core patent expired in 1990, so Mario never financially benefited from the widespread adoption of RFID automated toll collection systems in the 1990s. Walton and Cardullo are often referred to as the quote-unquote fathers of RFID technology, but I would hesitate to go that far. The ideas were there, but the execution was not ready yet for prime time. The RFID-ish system that the Port Authority asked GE, Philips, and everyone else to build was never implemented. It cost too much, the tags were too big, there were privacy issues that had to be worked out, and so on. So here we need to introduce a third father of RFID, government. In the 1970s, government laboratories in the United States were involved in RFID-ish development. They were motivated by two seemingly unconnected things: nukes and cows. A cow is an animal that we can get milk from. It moos. It is important to monitor and track an individual cow's eating and mating activities. But traditional ways of doing this were confusing. A better solution can save farmers a lot of time, effort, and money. At the same time, the Atomic Energy Commission was trying to figure out a way to track their nuclear bombs and raw materials. These were being transported on rail or trucks over long distances. It was fairly important not to lose a bomb or two. The Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory began working on a solution for the nukes, but then realized it can work for cows too. Thus, the Departments of Energy and Agriculture joined forces to fund this project. In 1975, the Los Alamos team published a landmark paper, Short-Range Radio Telemetry for Electronic Identification Using Modulated Backscatter. They laid out a semi-passive RFID tag system still used today in several RFID systems using higher wavelengths like microwaves. By 1982, the Los Alamos team delivered an RFID system to the Department of Energy, allowing trucks carrying nuclear materials to be tagged and tracked like a bear or something. In 1983, several companies spun off from this Los Alamos team to bring this RFID tracking technology to the private sector. One of those companies was Amtec, founded by one of the members of that Los Alamos team, Dr. Jerry Lant. Their technology was specifically designed for the challenges of rail and motor vehicles. Another company was Identronics, which had Victor Grinich, one of the trader's aide of Fairchild Semiconductor, as its CEO. Interesting coincidence. Anyway, Amtec turned out to be far more successful. Rail companies began adopting it in 1985, at first being used on a coal train from Illinois to St. Louis. The Association of American Railroads later adopted Amtec's RFID system as the industry standard. 2 years later, in 1987, we had the first commercial trial of an electronic toll road in western Norway. Another trial spun up on the Dallas North Turnpike in 1989, but these were proprietary systems, so no standards were involved. So in 1990, seven regional toll agencies in the eastern United States region collaborated on a mutually compatible electronic toll collection system, EasyPass. It was launched in 1993. Meanwhile, in 1991, the first electronic tolling system in America went live in Oklahoma. Others soon followed in Texas, Kansas, and so on. The RFID electronic toll road was well on its way to prominence. Many were supplied by Amtec. In 2000, Amtec was acquired by TransCore, a company providing assorted transportation systems. Today, many of our electronic tolling systems are made by TransCore. A second major event in 1990 greatly pushed forward RFID adoption in another part of the economy. Desert Storm brought together 500,000 American soldiers to fight Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, the biggest effort since Vietnam. It was a military success, but a logistical nightmare. 6.5 million tons of equipment were shipped to supply depots in the Middle East in huge containers with insufficient tracking. People lost track of things, leaving $2.7 billion worth of parts and supplies in the Saudi desert. The army realized that it needed a new way to track these goods as they made their way through the supply chain. Luckily, there was something already in development. In 1990, DARPA awarded a grant to a child tracking technology company called Savvy Technology, which developed an active RFID tag that can be put on cargo containers. The Army successfully adopted this technology and it allowed for a 30% reduction in logistical assets during deployment in Somalia and Bosnia. And then in 1998, two colleagues at MIT, Dr. Sanjay Sarma and Dr. David Brock, were batting around an idea. Brock worked in AI and Sarma in robotics. Brock suggested to Sarma the idea of a robot sensing objects around itself using radio waves and identifying codes rather than just sight. The idea of making RFID ubiquitous was exciting to them. In 1999, Brock, Sarma, and colleague Dr. Sunny Liu set up the Auto ID Center at MIT to establish wide standards for RFID technology. One of their most significant projects was a universal identifier code suited for RFID tags, Electronic Product Code, or EPC. Over time, large companies struggling with their supply chains like Procter & Gamble began adopting the EPC. They grew the standard and steadily drove down the cost of tags. One critical innovation was the use of a database to reduce the amount of data carried by the actual tag. Finally, on October 2003, Walmart announced that its 100 top suppliers would have to start tagging their pallets and cases with RFID tags by 2005. A week later, the Department of Defense did the same, adopting the EPC standard as well. These efforts took several years, but having both the world's largest retailer and the American Armed Forces on board rapidly drove RFID adoption and solidified its place in the global supply chain. To me, what is interesting about RFID's development is how a single technology with a single name can have so many different branches and histories. But it gives you a good sense of just how widespread the technology has become and how many use cases we can find for it in our everyday lives. RFID adoption has stalled somewhat in recent years, but perhaps the Uniqlo's self-checkout experience can kick off another big wave of adoption of this unheralded workhorse technology. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the newsletter, and I'll see you guys next time.